In the old market, we had these high desks with the flaps on, the sort you would experience at in the school classroom. And when it came to the cannons part in the la 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 la, all these desks would crash down all around the stock exchange, and you'd probably have a good 1,000 people singing. And this is the dome was it was absolutely marvellous for acoustics, and it was just one of those things that would suddenly start up. Standing next to me was a chap called Geoffrey Beck, and his father was sort of third joint senior partner of a firm called Haddo and Turner. And he, like myself, was introduced to the firm because that was what was expected of him. And a little chap called Thimbleby, maybe Dimbleby with Gal Parsons, maybe Greenwell I think he was, he was the choir man, and he used to roll up a Denny Brothers offer list, which was rather an A4 size plus, roll it up into a baton, and probably about 2:30 one any given afternoon, he would start tuning up, la 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 la, and then people would realise that we were going to have this old song, and the song was "I'm Following My Father's Footsteps, I'm Following My Dear Old Dad," and it would be sung right through the normal speed, and then it would be sung through again at double speed, and there was always the call at the end, "Where's my boy?" Mm-hmm. And it was evidently something he would probably look around the pitch to find out where his son was, and that was one of the things he used to say. And the day he retired from a firm called Wilson and Watford, I managed to get part of the Stock Exchange choir around, and we gave him a last rendering of it, and he was in tears. He was nearly 80, I suppose, really. He said, "I know who that was," shaking his finger at me. I said, "Well, Geoffrey, we couldn't let you go without one more song." So, but they was, you know, some of the characters. There was the chicken, the lighthouse. The lighthouse, actually, he stood in the mining market and he was always moving his head around, and it reminded people of the light flashing on the top of the lighthouse. So what his name was, I can't know, but Jeff, some of the others might remember it. We had the chap called the Tortoise, and I think he was with a firm called T. Hammond, and he looked like a tortoise. He was a little bit round-shouldered. He always wore a bowler hat, brown suit, and carried his umbrella, and his nose would remind anybody that he was a tortoise, and he used to walk very sort of slowly through the market. And it was, they were, people, you know, automatically got these. Esmond Durlacher was known as the emperor. Father was occasionally called the King of the Dogs because he specialised in that. But just after the war, Father was also known as the Gas Mask because he was an ARP warden on Draper's Gardens when it was only 3 stories high and not the skyscraper it is now, 24. But that really sort of disappeared, I think, when the war disappeared. I think Gas Mask disappeared. Mm-hmm. Standing next to me was a fellow called Jerry Barber, and he looked like a parrot. And that was often a source of amusement. Chap named Nicky Nichols, Tom Nichols with Haddo, would imitate a parrot and rather take the mickey, which he usually get terribly annoyed about. So, but they were only when things were quiet. This is the sort of thing that, you know, would happen, really.
Do you have any recollections of what business was like in the Stock Exchange during the late 40s?
The late 40s wasn't terrible. We had the boom in 40, I think the Greyhound boom was 47, 48-ish, and then I think it tailed right off. You must remember that jobbers tend to deal in markets, and they actually stood in markets. There was the mining market, and there would be the East African, the West African, the Rhodesian, Australian, and then you had the rubber market. And it was really almost, in the early days, one firm stuck to one market. And it wouldn't be unusual for your section to perhaps go quiet for 2 or 3 weeks. You're not doing any trade at all. And the gilt market might be busy. And I suppose in some ways it was very beneficial for the brokers because they could switch their clients' money round a bit. I think when we got to the later years where jobbing firms were in all markets, their capital was... I don't say thinly spread, but the capital is being used in all markets. And I think there could have been problems with this, really. I think very often you get a movement in a share, perhaps in the industrial market, that was fairly quiet, where the senior said, right, we'll clear out that book. Mm. And for some unknown reason, it appeared that a market would, or a stock, or two or three stocks would start sort of falling out of bed. And it was really purely a market maker, or a jobber, as we termed them, was thinning his book down. Mm. Which didn't happen. It was one of those cycles that gradually got built in, I think, after a while. Made it very difficult for brokers to assess markets, because you'd very often get a stock going completely against the trend, excellent figures, but because the jobber was, that section were told to clear the book out, then it could have an effect on that stock or that section even. Yes, and some of the, you know, the thin days, they were thin, really. I suppose the worst year I ever experienced was 73, I think, was probably the worst, where we traded for a whole year and never made a shilling. Mm. All the staff paid, all the expenses paid, and really that was the bad year.
Mm. Well, let's leap back a bit from 73 to, was it 1951 when you became authorised?
No, I went straight in as a member in 1960. I wasn't actually authorised. No, I don't. No, I went straight in as a member. No, I beg your pardon. I was authorised. I was authorised with a firm called Thompson Schwab. Mm. That was after William C. Bray. I was there about a year. Mm. That would have been in 1956.
I see. And then you were authorised to deal. That's what I
was authorised to trade. Yes, for the broker.
For the broker. When did you actually start working as an authorised clerk with a jobbing firm?
Officially, that was 1960. Right. But as a blue button, I did. It was completely forbidden, but I did trade a little bit. Mm. I remember Father had gone out for his. Father always went for his drink at 11:30. He never went for coffee. He started trading at 9:30. And his first break would be a half a beer in Slater's Bodega Bar in Throgmorton Street. There'd probably be six of them meet up, half a beer, and then he would come back in again. And while he was out for his 10-minute break, Mr. Goodison came on the pitch, which was the uncle of the past chairman. And the firm was called H.E. Goodison. And he stood on the pitch and he looked round, and I was obviously the only one there with wearing my blue button. And he said, ask me a price or something. And I made him a price. He said, I want to trade. I said, well, that's all right, sir. I'll give you a slip and that will confirm it. So he said, all right. So he sold me 5,000 shares and I wrote out a slip, we buy from you. And he smiled and went on his way. And he said to me, he said, one of us two ought to go upstairs. And that was all he said, and away he walked. When Father came back from his drink, I've bought 5,000 shares from Mr. Goodison. I gave him a slip. I said, but he did say to me, one of us two ought to go upstairs. And I was a bit puzzled about this. He said, well, he is the deputy chairman and you're not authorised to trade. And nothing more was ever said about that. Mm. I think you had to show a little bit of initiative as a blue button. Otherwise, you'd never get your authorisation, really. Mm. There was always this little bit of a fringe on it. Mm. Really, which and people were keen to get your authorisation, and you lost your blue buttons badge then. You see, you didn't wear any badge at all then. Mm-hmm. So it was quite an honour.
How did you find moving from jobbing firms to broking firms, then back again?
I always preferred
fairly easily.
No, not really. Mm-hmm. I always preferred the jobbing side. Mm-hmm. I always felt a little uneasy on the broking, because they're things change so quickly, you know, and some of these jobbers are very unreliable. I remember posting, in the early days, you'd post a blue buttons job was to post prices from the boards. Well, if you found out the jobbers after a while who were a bit reluctant to change their board prices, it may be that they've done a deal and they want to broadcast to the world. And I remember posting this price in Hawker Siddeley when I was with Thompson Schwab, and it was about a shilling out in price, because my governor got an order to sell 5,000 shares, and because when I couldn't do it near the board price, he went potty. Unfortunately, when he came down in the afternoon, as he usually did, this price was still the same on the board. But that was didn't make any difference to him. I'd let the side down, as it were. So, you know, it was... there was always this uncertainty that you couldn't actually... Unless, of course, you exchange limits and the business was left firm with you, there was never any certainty that when you went back that you could, in fact, trade again. And particularly if markets were moving. I mean, if you haven't got a firm order, this is the point. If you haven't got a firm order and you've been limited to sell 500 shares, by the time you've got a price and gone back on, and we're talking about the old days, you see, where you had to rely on backwards and forwards on a telephone. You know, the price could be 2 or 3 shillings different by the time you got back again. And I don't think that really suited my character, I don't think. I'd rather be in charge of what I was doing rather than at somebody else's mercy. Because when the telephones came in, two-way radios, I mean, you're on the jobber's pitch and you say, look, the best bet is £1.50, and the chap says, right, sell. And you've done it and you can walk away. But, I mean, 2 or 3 minutes could, or even longer. So communications were very poor, I think, in the early days.
Did the brokers have a particular attitude towards jobbers?
The majority, I think, respected them, realising that they've got to deal again tomorrow. Mm-hmm. You know, I remember I was on the authorisation panel, blue buttons to authorise clerks, and there used to be 2 members, one jobber, one broker, and a member from the membership staff, and we used to examine the candidates as per the green book as it was laid down, which was the standard practice of trading. And one of the questions is, what would you do if you found a choice price? The answer was, well, you would inform the jobber and trade. Well, this lad came up in front of us, and the question was put to him. He said, I would give the man 3 farthings more, or 1/2 more. And the broker at the other end looked very puzzled about this. He said, well, you don't have to. So he said, well, no, sir, but that's what I would do. Anyway, in the early days, the candidate had to retire, and then we had to discuss whether we were going to pass him or not. And this broker said, I don't agree with that. And I said, well, I can tell you it is this firm's policy never to deal on a choice price. And the reason is that if there's ever a mistake in any of their bargains, particularly with my firm, we will always put it right. So if 2 days later he comes round and says, oh, that bargain I did with you, my client hasn't got the stock that I sold you. And you get your jobbing book up, you turn up the date, you say, I'll cancel it. But brokers that, as we termed it, were always screwing, always wanted to deal at the keenest price, one never felt you needed to put their bargains right for nothing. And that was the quality, I think, of the relationship between a broker and a jobber as to how he got his bargains put right. And there's no doubt about it, certain brokers favoured certain jobbers, so they saw most of their trade. It might have been a common denominator between the two traders, or they collected stamps, or both belonged to the same tennis club. But there was this complete trust in their relationship, and you know, perhaps it wasn't always a good thing to do all your business with one person. I have had a broker where I've been doing a lot of his business, and he said, well, the opposition's been on, his book's in a mess, and he said, I really feel I ought to trade with him. And I say, well, yeah, feel free. Mm. You know, I think that there's an open attitude was always better, I think, rather than trying to do the broker's business 100%. Mm. So it was all down to personalities at the end of the day, really. Mm. If somebody came round, you know, accusing you of all sorts of things, well then I would never put a bargain right that one of my colleagues had done. I would listen to what the broker said, and I'd say, right, well, okay, well, when my man comes back from lunch, I'll discuss it with him and we'll see who's right and who's... Well, you wouldn't actually say see who's right and who's wrong. You want to know the circumstances. And invariably you would put it right, but it wasn't you. The golden rule was you didn't alter somebody else's bargain, because there might have been some conversation that had taken place that you've got no right to alter it, really. Mm. But by and large, I think, you know, the relationships were quite good. The ones that you didn't get on with, you didn't trade with or try to avoid trading with them. But it wasn't always the broker's fault sometimes. I mean, it might have been their clients, or it might have been that you're dealing with an authorised clerk that's dealing on behalf of the senior partner, and this lad's got to earn a living, and he sometimes has to do what his senior partner tells him. And sometimes it was incorrect for that clerk to do that, do the business that way. So there had to be a little bit of understanding about it.
So in 1960, you joined your father.
Yes.
And you formed S. Jenkins and Son.
Yeah.
Had you moved from a broking firm?
No, I was with the S. Godden then. That was the jobbing firm father actually went to.
Had you been a dealer with them?
No, I was purely a blue button with them.
So you started dealing as a jobber.
Officially.
Officially, yes. In 1960.
That's it, yes.
Yes. What was it like starting off? Was it like starting a new firm, or was it
not really,
firm
no.
to change names?
No, because we actually stayed on the same pitch. Mm. We didn't. In fact, Father's pitch was the same pitch he was on in the 30s. Mm. I mean, this was something that was treasured and protected at all times. I mean, as a junior, I remember sitting down on Haddo and Turner's pitch to put a page in a jobbing book, because I was a bit sort of fingers and thumbs in the early days, and we had loose leaf books, and I wasn't sitting down there 10 seconds, and one of their partners was most abusive to me and told me to clear off his pitch, and it was as silly as that, really, in the early days. Mm-hmm. But there was this overprotection of your dealing pitch. Mm. And that your dealing pitch could be a small board on the wall, perhaps 24 inches by 12 inches, and somewhere to stand probably 4 feet away from that. Mm. And that was your pitch. Mm. But nobody else. And then if you knew a firm was closing down, and they were friendly towards you, they would, as we did, we moved pitches, but we only moved about 4 feet to the right. We knew the firm was shutting down, and as they literally took their board off the wall, ours went on it. And there was no application for a pitch. And no charges for pitches in the early days. I mean, it was all for free. I remember saying to Father one day, I said, do you realise we must have the cheapest shop in the City of London? He said, what do you mean? I said, well, our combined fees in those days was £125. And I said, that's all we pay, I said, for this pitch, £125. I said, we've got rates and the rent's paid. I said, we've got electric lighting, heating, I said, and a captive audience. And of course, when the Stock Exchange was rebuilt, they started making a charge for it. Mm-hmm. But it was remarkable when you think back. I suppose this is why there were so many small firms. The overheads were peanuts, really. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was, different days.
And you were dealing purely in leisure entertainment?
Leisure, yeah. Greyhounds, amusement parks. That really was what it was all about. Then we did take up a few sweet cheers. I remember Elizabeth Shaw, Jamieson Chocolates. And there was another one as well we used to trade in. And that didn't prove too. There again, all you to deal in these shares, you just wrote them up on a board. There was no, you didn't have to apply to anybody. Mm. Equally, if you wanted to stop trading in them, you just took them off the board. And there was a book called The Squirt's Guide, which was kept by a firm called James Case. Which every stock that was traded in, James Case used to keep this thing updated, or probably one of the boys did. On their pitch, and if you weren't certain who traded in this stock, you'd look it up, and written alongside it was the initials of the firm. Except, of course, if James Case dealt in it, you'd only have JC against it, and you'd have to whistle around for the others. But that was a very good guide for the juniors coming into the market. Mm. Before a chap named Connolly introduced this Squirt's Guide and made an annual publication of it. And that actually probably was the first time that a firm were registered as traders in that particular stock, because we did have some problems at one stage. A jobber registered in a stock was entitled to issue a 10-bob stamp. That was if he found himself a bull of the stock at the end of the account, he was allowed this concession that whatever the amount of the stock was or the consideration, he only paid 10 shillings nominal stamp at the stamp office. But you had to be a registered trader, and there was one firm that was doing cashing you or financing brokers' clients' holdings, and this chap used to issue these 10-bob stamps in stocks that he wasn't registered in. And I remember when the case came to before the Stock Exchange Council, the Squirt's Guide was actually used as the Bible as to whether he was a full registered person or not. So, and then of course it developed, and then the Stock Exchange in fact took it over officially after that. So, but now to trade in a stock you must register, I think, 48 hours beforehand, and you can't trade in it unless it shows on the screen. So there's a lot more restrictions. Mm.
About how many other jobbers were there in your market during the early 60s?
I think there was about 10. Mm. It was rather surprising, actually. I discovered one the other day. It was Flower Ridehower. I never knew they actually dealt in greyhound shares. A friend of mine's father was a senior partner there, and he found one of their old price lists, and there was the greyhound shares on it. But they were all characters, really.
Mm. Was it very competitive?
Oh yes, very, very, very competitive. In fact, I think there was only two firms finished trading in, and that one was Smith Brothers, and the other one was ourselves, Jenkins. Mm. Well, it was probably the market in them. But a lot of the other smaller firms sort of disappeared.
Mm. How did you compare in size with the other jobbers in that market?
The smallest, I think. Mm. We never ever did claim to be on the large size. I think father's attitude of trading was always we never borrowed money, and we never borrowed stock, which were two facilities that most other firms did. And father's attitude was, I like to sleep at night, and we earned a good living out of the business, and the staff all did well. And father's attitude was, well, why should I overtrade? That was something that he was always frightened of. Because you've got to remember also, father saw a lot of hammerings, a lot of firms went broke in his time, and I suppose he always had it in the back of his mind, well, I won't overtrade, and I'm going to survive, you know. Mm. So really that was probably his upbringing. Mm. I remember Powell with Pinchin saying to father that they were talking one day, and they said, well, you're definitely under trading, and father said, well, I like it that way, you know. And we kept independent really right the way through.
Was that, do you think, the main reason why you managed to survive while many other firms simply disappeared?
Well, yes, I think those people liked trading with us because we were a small family firm. I think they liked us because all the other firms were getting larger and larger, and a lot of people did prefer the personal attitude, you know. I want a bargain altered. Yes, okay, we'll just ring the office, they'll sort that out for you. The other firms had computer alterations, and it would take 2 or 3 days. And it was like going into the corner shop as against going into, Harrods. You know, it was that sort of attitude. And I think, we'd all been in the business a long time, and people had grown up with us, and I suppose we had a good reputation. And, it was quite a nice feeling, actually, you know.
Had you ever thought of expanding the firm?
Well, we looked at it on one or two occasions, but I think because we were getting a good living out of it, I think we were a bit complacent, I think, really. I mean, we did take up other companies. We took up cleaning companies. We took up laundry shares. And then I'm not certain what the year was. It might have been in the 70s, I suppose. When the holiday camp businesses were being absorbed, Warners went to, we'll come back to Warners. Pontins went into Corals. Butlins was the first to go, I think, really. They went into Ranks. And then one or two of the bookmaking companies which we traded in, they started getting smaller and smaller. And we suddenly found ourselves with less stocks to trade in. And... We then in those days we had a jobbers committee, and I called a meeting, sought an audience, because I wasn't a member of this jobbers committee, and said that we intended to take up the whole of the hotel section, because we had lost quite a large percentage of our turnover. Pontins and Butlins was quite big trading stocks, and we also had another rule that we wouldn't take up the other stock unless it was in our section. There was no point in taking up ranks, because we didn't do the whole of that section, and I think because we always took a moral stand on this, I think when we said we're going to take up the hotels, they said, you know, good luck to you. And I think Michael Sargent was probably one of those. In the later years, we had a very good, close relationship with all our opposition. We were always included in any discussions that were going on about market changes, and I think our views were always valued, I think. Because some of the discussions weren't always about the market making side, they were, you know, settlement side and costs and all this sort of thing. It was becoming quite a big area for discussion, really.
Were you limited in the size of the bargain you could do?
No, only what common sense, you know, prevailed in. Obviously, by the 70s onwards, apart from the 73 bad time, our capital, of course, was we were ploughing it back in. But father and I, we weren't big spenders. Father was always a prudent person, and we always ploughed our profits back into the firm. And then when I took over for a short while, I insisted then that the junior partners left a bit more in, so that by the time we got to the 80s, we were much better equipped for trading. And also we had facilities for borrowing, and we also had this stock lending and borrowing situation, which I don't know whether you know, but when you're a bear, you can take the stock in again. You must go to a registered broker. I think there were three in those days. Shepherd's, Lorry and Heseltine Power were the three main brokers. So if you had a bear position, it had to be a fairly reasonable position, 50,000, 100,000, you could go to them and borrow the stock against your position, and they would deliver it to you. You would deliver it onto your open positions, and you would be paid a rate. Mm. So you've got an interest rate on your short positions, and which could balance up on your bull side, really. Mm. In theory, you should run a book. If you've got a fairly balanced book of size, you should be able to run that for nothing. Mm. And your expenses were purely staff and your office side. So that was another method, which is one we used in the latter years.
If we can go back a little bit to when you started as Jenkins and Son.
Yeah.
Can you describe what it was like actually trading on the floor of the house? Perhaps you could describe a typical day from the trip into the office and going through each stage, and then describe what actually went on in the process of dealing.
Yes, we would arrive in the office always early birds, probably quarter to nine. We'd have a general discussion of what was going on. In those days, the market opened at 9:30 for the brokers and the jobbers. We all had to rush in together, which was really highly unsatisfactory. It was something that was altered later on, where the jobbers went in a quarter of an hour earlier to clean the boards up, read any company announcements, so be better prepared, really, to start. So it really was quite frightening in the early days to all go in at 9:30 and get all these things sorted out. I mean, the first quarter of an hour could be quite a lot of pressure, really. I think the other thing as well, if a company announcement came out, you're all fighting around it, and you've only read one part of it, and the other chap's read something part of it. And I've remembered a difference of 3 shillings. We were offering Butlins at 19 shillings a share, and I remember Dolacker were bidding 22 shillings, and that was the sort of I don't know, uncontrolled sort of situation that you had. It was a bit panicky, really, and this all gradually got ironed out, really. I think that was probably the worst moment. It was like waiting for a bullfight when the when you knew that Butlin's figures were coming out at 11 o'clock or any of the major companies that you traded in. And you'd probably have about 50 or 60 people round you. And the other jobbers would have exactly the same, bearing in mind that there was no communication between anybody in those days. It was quite frightening. Mm. And also the first day of a new issue. You've gone in there, you've got your books open. This was in the early days when the jobbers went in first. And there's three of you lining up there and to either side of the chap that's going to run the book to protect him. And then you've got all these brokers come hurling through the market like madmen. And there would have been accidents and people's heads cut open. And it was very, very unorderly and very unsatisfactory, really.
When did this start to change?
It's difficult, isn't it? These things change without you probably knowing them, really. I'm just trying to think what caused it to change. It was the last big issue that I can really remember like this was British Telecom, when we dressed up with our blue helmets on, and that was fairly. It was busy, but there was.